Good evening and welcome to the Finch Lecture. I'm Professor Margaret Abernethy and I'm Dean of the Faculty of Economics and Commerce. And I'd like to welcome you all to this very important lecture, which we hold on an annual basis. I'd particularly like to welcome our Chancellor, Alex Chernoff. Of course, our guest speaker, Professor Howard Davies, his wife, who is also accompanying him. And we also have tonight Professor John Finch, the son of the lecture on which the son of the Finch, who this lecture is named after. I'm delighted to see so many of my colleagues in the faculty, my colleagues around the university, and also those from outside the university. I know this is going to be a very interesting lecture, and to actually introduce our speaker, I'll call on our Chancellor, Alex Chernoff. Thank you very much.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to see so many here today in this magnificent theatre, which was only finished not so long ago. I remember the first time I saw this, it was a shell. It was the most unattractive, cold shell, and I really didn't believe the architects when they told me this was going to be a magnificent theatre with magnificent acoustics, and of course, they were right. It's a great pleasure, of course, as I've said, to welcome you to this 2009 David Finch Lecture and introduce our illustrious speaker this evening. But before doing so, can I make 2 points? First, I'd like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional owners of the land on which this lecture will take place. And I would also like to honour the person after whom the lecture is named, namely David Finch, who was an alumnus of this university. He graduated from here with joint honours degrees in commerce and arts in 1944. And in 1948, he completed his PhD at Sir Howard Davis' institution, the London School of Economics. After a short time in Tasmania, David Finch was appointed to the then newly established International Monetary Fund, where he spent the rest of his working life. And when he resigned in 1987, he was its councillor and also director of exchange and trade. It's through David Finch's generosity that we're able to have this lecture series. His achievements were recognised by the University of Melbourne in 2000 by the award 2 years before his untimely death of an honorary doctorate in commerce. It also gives me great pleasure to join the Dean in welcoming David's family and David's son in particular, Professor John Finch. He's come all the way from Washington, D.C. to be here this evening. This is the 13th Finch Lecture, and over the years, the faculty has developed a fine tradition of attracting the world's leading economics and finance experts from academia, government, and international agencies. Since 1997, the David Finch Lecture has been given by a number of renowned international speakers, ranging from Jeffrey Sachs of Harvard, Stanley Fisher, the Deputy Director of the IMF, and Dr. Supachi Panicharti, Deputy Prime Minister of Thailand. Tonight, that tradition continues, and it's a great privilege for us to have Sir Howard Davies, Director of the London School of Economics since September 2003, as the 2009 David Finch Lecturer. Sir Howard had a most impressive career in the world outside and, of course, within finance and banking. Since 1997, or between 1997 and 2003, he was chairman of the Financial Services Authority, the single regulator of the UK financial sector, which was created, actually under his leadership, from 9 separate regulating agencies. From 1995 to 1997, he was Deputy Governor of the Bank of England, and before that, between 1992 and 5. He was the Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, and from 1987 to 1992, Control of the Audit Commission. He was also for 6 years a Director of GKN and a member of the International Advisory Board of NatWest. In his earlier career, he worked in Britain in the Foreign and Commonwealth Office of the Treasury, both as an official and as a special advisor to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and for 5 years worked as a management consultant for McKinsey & Company. Somehow, Sir Howard managed to find time to make valuable contributions to the community in areas quite outside banking and finance. For example, throughout his career, Sir Howard has written widely for various publications, reviewing fiction for the Literary Review and the Times, and historical and economic books for The Economist, The Times, The Times Literary Supplement, and The Times Higher Education, amongst other publications. In 2007, he chaired the judges for the Man Booker Prize for Fiction, and he was a trustee of the Tate, a member of the governing body of the Royal Academy of Music, patron of working families, and in 2004, he was elected Honorary Fellow at Merton College. He writes regularly for the Financial Times, which is unsurprising, and they were lucky to have that done for them, and he's lectured extensively at home and overseas, and is a regular participant in the World Economic Forum in Davos. Moreover, Sir Howard's contribution had no geographic boundaries. Thus, since 2003, for example, he has been a member of the International Advisory Councils of the China Banking Regulatory Commission and the China Securities Regulatory Commission. In 2004, he joined the board of Morgan Stanley as a non-executive director, and in 2006 joined the board of Patermost, a new insurance company, and in 2009 he became advisor to the Government Investment Corporation in Singapore. In 2006, Sir Howard edited and introduced The Chancellor's Tales, a book on British economic policy from 1975 to 2000, and in 2008 he jointly authored Global Financial Regulations, The Essential Guide, and I'm told of a new book by him and his co-author on central banks and the crisis is to be published next year by Princeton University Press. It's one of these remarkable things that Melbourne University Press has missed out on. It's a long way to come, Sir Howard, and to deliver this lecture this evening, ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Sir Howard Davies.
Well, thank you very much, Chancellor, and to Dean Abernethy for the introduction. I'm very pleased to be back in Melbourne, a city I regard as the Manchester of the Southern Hemisphere, generally with the weather to match, as it certainly had yesterday. I should say that as a Mancunian myself, that should be regarded as a compliment. I was first in Melbourne, actually, in 1977, when I came here for the Ashes Test series of 1977-8. And for those of you who are too young to remember or with short memories, we won that series handsomely. And of course, this time we have chosen to make the series a little bit more exciting by throwing the Headingley test in order to have a denouement at the Oval next week, which I'm sure is going to make me a very happy man indeed. Now, I'm very honoured to have been invited to deliver the David Finch lecture this year, and particularly honoured that his son should have, on the spur of the moment, decided to come over from Washington, which is a very nice thing to happen to establish that family link. Finch was, of course, a very distinguished Australian, a very distinguished economist, the most senior Australian at the IMF. And indeed, we share many common interests in international finance and in higher education. I don't think that we ever met, though I say this with some hesitation, because One thing that David Finch is very much remembered for in the UK is that he was the leader of the IMF mission to the United Kingdom in 1976, when the country was about to go bust. And we had to receive an IMF mission to tell us to cut our spending and stop being so profligate. This was, of course, a rather marking experience for the UK. And I was, in fact, in the building in the Treasury at that time as a junior official, but too junior to be involved in discussions with the team we regarded as being the receivers at that time. If David Finch were around today, his experience would be very relevant, because we may well be receiving another IMF visitation before too long, with a PSB, a public sector borrowing requirement of 15% and a growth rate of about minus 5%. Things are not looking too hot. Finch's perspective on the current crisis would have been very valuable, with his academic background allied to a first-hand understanding of the complexity of global policymaking at the fund. And I'll try my best to match that combination this evening, though in a different way, as my own policymaking experience is primarily domestic. I should also mention, as the Chancellor referred to the book about central banking, which will be published next year, that my co-author David Green was in fact a very close friend of David Finch's at the IMF. So there are many linkages here this evening. Now, the question that I'll explore tonight may seem a little obscure to the man on the Carlton tram or the woman at the bar in Jimmy Watson's. But it is one which, in central banking circles today, generates a lot of heat, partly because there are genuine disagreements on how best to calibrate monetary policy and how far to take asset prices into account, but also because the answer determines the degree of culpability which attaches to central banks for the crisis, which continues to engulf the world's financial markets and the global economy. Now, in the UK, given our particularly extreme financial position, this is a very dramatic set of issues. Of course, Australia, living up once more to its lucky country designation, is less badly affected than most. Here you have the BIS view of growth rates and fiscal packages, and your economy is not expected to contract anything like as severely as the UK's, and your banks are in much better shape than ours, no doubt due to the careful supervision exercised by APRA under its LSE-educated boss, John Laker. Indeed, it may be that Australia ends up as the only OECD country to avoid technical recession, partly, of course, because of the size of the fiscal stimulus, which, as you can see, by international standards, is large. It's small in the UK because of our poor financial position, which is why Gordon Brown will, I think, soon take his place in the John Howard Twilight Home for retired prime ministers. But even in Australia, in spite of this large fiscal stimulus, unemployment is rising and the prospects for growth in the coming years are subdued at best. Globally, the latest estimates are that the financial crisis will cost around $9 trillion. And to paraphrase Ronald Reagan, a trillion here, a trillion there, and pretty soon you're talking real money. And unemployment is going to rise by tens of millions. Forecasters expect 3 million out of work in the UK by the end of next year. In Australia, most estimates suggest a rise to around 8%. And for Britain, this is already the fourth largest fiscal shock in history after the Napoleonic War and the two world wars of the 20th century. In the US, the position is even more stark. The commitments made in relation to this crisis are already more than twice the size of the cost of World War II to the United States government. So in these circumstances, it's not surprising that a blame game is well underway. The famous special relationship between the US and the UK has come under some strain, with Gordon Brown regularly claiming that this crisis was, like Bruce Springsteen, born in the USA. The French lumped the two of us together and see the crisis as a crisis of Anglo-Saxon capitalism. In the US itself, amazingly, a Boston Globe survey just recently showed that 32% of Democrats believe the crisis was caused by the Jews. No doubt the Greeks blame the Turks and vice versa, and Australians will no doubt be true to type and blame the umpires. In the financial world, politicians blame regulators for being asleep at the wheel, regulators blame the banks, the commercial banks blame themselves, blame the investment banks for selling them securitizations they didn't understand, and they blame the accounting standard setters for requiring them to reveal the losses they'd rather have kept quiet. The investment banks blame the hedge funds for shorting their stock and the private equity houses for persuading them to lend on highly leveraged deals, and everyone blames the rating agencies. They're the people we can all love to hate. So in a crisis of this magnitude, there's plenty of blame to go around. Even academics have come in for their share, for continuing to teach efficient markets theory in finance classes and focusing too much on growth theory in economics. One of our own economics professors, Willem Bouter, wrote a lengthy mea culpa in his FT blog the other day on behalf of the profession entitled "The Unfortunate Uselessness of Most Monetary Economics." This may be something of a disappointment to the students here who are engaged in courses of monetary economics. And it went down extremely well in the LSE common room, as you can imagine. But Paul Krugman made a similar point in a lecture at the LSE in June, describing the recent period as a dark age for the profession. So with all that blame spread around, is there any opprobrium left for central banks? Well, I think I might this evening be able to find a little so that they do not feel neglected, because it's far worse, of course, to be ignored than it is to be criticized. What charge may be laid at the central bank's door? Well, Charlie Bean, the deputy governor of the Bank of England, hinted at it recently when, having listed all the manifold sins of the banks and regulators, he said, "But you need fuel to make a fire too, and that was provided by the ex ante excess." Central bankers love the odd Latin tag. "The ex ante excess supply of global savings over investment, which pushed real interest rates on safe assets to historically low levels, reinforced by loose monetary policy." Now, others put forward an even stronger version of that critique and maintain firmly that the crisis was made in the Fed. Steve Roach, the chief economist of Morgan Stanley, doesn't mince his words. Central banks, he argues, were asleep at the switch. Central banks failed to provide a stable underpinning to world financial markets and to an increasingly asset-dependent global economy. It's high time for monetary authorities to adopt new procedures, namely taking asset markets into explicit consideration when framing policy, as the increasing prevalence of bubbles indicates a failure to recognize the interplay between the state of asset markets and the real economy is an egregious policy error. And Roach's call for a shift away from a narrow focus on consumer price inflation has been reinforced by arguments that the CPI itself has been giving false readings. One big part of the story of the crisis is the huge growth in the global current account imbalances that occurred from 2003 onwards. As you can see from this, the US, which is the green bar, was a massive deficit country, and the oil exporters in yellow and China in blue were massive surplus countries. Competition from China held down the prices of traded goods, while leading participants in financial markets grew incontinently rich, recycling excess liquidity created by central banks, misled into a belief that inflation had been conquered and that a productivity revolution was underway. The critics consider that this reading of inflation was fundamentally wrong and that the CPI itself was really, as one economist has dubbed it, Chinese price inflation, held artificially low by the Chinese export boom. And in fact, during the so-called Great Moderation, a massive expansion of credit was underway, leading in turn to mispricing of risk and asset price bubbles, all under the noses of central bankers myopically monitoring their narrowly defined inflation objectives. Indeed, the period demonstrates an interesting asymmetry. Central banks used imported low inflation to declare victory in hitting their targets while running a relatively loose monetary policy, as measured by the low level of real interest rates, for example, or by the Taylor rule for much of the 1970s. I'm talking John Taylor, not Mark Taylor, whose rule was to score hundreds against England, sadly. The Taylor rule specifies by how much a central bank should change interest rates in response to the divergence of actual from potential GDP and actual from target inflation. Specifically, it says that the interest rate should be 1.5 times the inflation rate plus half the GDP gap plus one. There'll be a test on that later. But when commodity prices rose, the central banks argued it was necessary to exceed the target for a period. Taylor himself points out that interest rates in the US were, from the end of 2001, held very significantly below the level which his rule, which had been a good representation of the Fed's behavior in an earlier period, would have indicated. Indeed, by 2004, rates in the US were fully 3 percentage points lower. And he argues that this deliberately loose monetary policy was the direct cause of the house price boom and subsequent bust. And he further shows that those European countries where the deviation from the rule was the greatest experienced similar house price bubbles. Now, less aggressive critics acknowledge the judgments made were defensible, and you can't reasonably expect central banks to manage asset prices as they control consumer inflation, but nonetheless that they could have done more to moderate the massive escalation in asset prices and credit expansion which preceded the crash. Real interest rates were very low indeed, as you can see in the UK. Sushil Wadhwani, who was for a while an external member of the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, believes his colleagues were captives of an outdated, almost religious belief in efficient markets. They would rather carry out inflation forecasting, targeting policy on the assumption that financial markets are efficient and there are no bubbles, he said. Robert Shiller of Princeton has advanced a related critique, pointing to the dramatic moves in asset prices in the early years of the century, which were impossible, as he argues, to justify by reference to supply and demand. Now, at the time, however, most central bank governors did not accept the argument that asset prices were giving dangerous signals. Be wrong to suggest, though, that there was one single view, because Bill White, the chief economist at the BIS, also argued for a greater focus on credit expansion and asset prices well before the crisis hit. Surely, he argued, there was a point at which it was possible to identify asset mispricing and bubbles. And why couldn't interest rate policy take some account of the risk posed by escalating asset prices, just as it did with other risks to inflation and growth? White concluded that while stable prices may bring many benefits, they don't exclude financial sector shocks, and that just as there was a willingness to tolerate the first round effects of negative supply shocks on inflation, as in the massive expansion of Chinese trade, there should perhaps be a willingness to tolerate deflation arising from positive supply shocks. Having accepted that the status quo had delivered a period of rapid growth and low inflation, he argued that with a monetary policy focused on price stability, the endemic pro-cyclical characteristics of the financial system would only meet with resistance to the extent that they triggered inflationary pressures. And he thought that responding to the downturn through the bursting of a credit bubble just through asymmetrically easier monetary policies afterwards was an inadequate response. And Andrew Crockett, who was then general manager of the BIS, put the argument very clearly in 2003. In a monetary regime in which the central bank's operational objective is expressed exclusively in terms of short-term inflation, there may be insufficient protection against the buildup of financial imbalances that lies at the root of much of the financial stability we observe. This could be so if the focus on short-term inflation control meant the authorities did not tighten policy sufficiently preemptively to lean against excessive credit expansion and asset price increases. So there were people arguing before this boom and bust that the central banks should have been reacting. And there's no doubt, of course, that credit expansion was very rapid, especially household credit. The UK and the US observed a dramatic boom in household debt as a share of disposable income. But frankly, on this measure, hats off, or should I say floppy greens off, to the Australians, with household debt doubling in a decade. In the UK, mortgage debt went from 50 to 85% of GDP in less than a decade. Now, this is the case, if you like, for the prosecution. How did the central banks respond to this heterodox critique? Well, Greenspan himself led the counterattack, and he challenged every link in the chain of the argument. In his view, it wasn't possible to identify, first of all, when a bubble was inflating, and even if it were possible, a monetary response would be ineffective. He said the notion that a well-timed incremental tightening could have been calibrated to prevent the late 90s bubble is almost surely an illusion. Furthermore, it would be undesirable to attempt to respond in a way which might constrain markets and hinder the processes of innovation. Instead, central banks should focus on policies to mitigate the fallout when it occurs and ease the transition to the next expansion. While liberalized capital markets may be prone to booms and busts, and there's evidence that the incidence of busts is growing, the net result, in his view, remains positive in terms of economic welfare, and attempting to interfere directly in the process of creative destruction which accompanies these intermittent crises would be counterproductive. Now, these contrasting points of view seem to admit little possibility of accommodation. Yet there are more recent signs that central banks, faced with the massive value destruction of the last 2 years, are becoming more pensive about this issue. And some are now taking a rather different line. If the bust is so dramatic, bringing economic and social destruction on a massive scale, should we not at least consider whether we might have done more to avert it? So I think it's worth picking through the details of the dispute to see if the outline of a new and potentially more effective approach might emerge, one which doesn't compromise the success achieved in anti-inflation policy, but gives somewhat greater weight to financial stability. And to do so, I think it's useful to parse the dispute into a series of issues on which different points of view are advanced. First of all, should central banks target asset prices? Well, here there is a large measure of agreement. The Locus Classicus of the case for taking more account of asset prices by Cecchetti says it's important to emphasize that we are recommending that while central banks might react to asset price misalignments, they must not target them. So the argument is not about adjusting the definition of inflation on an ad hoc basis as asset prices fluctuate. It's about how far decision makers should take account of asset price misalignments in setting rates and in determining the appropriate inflation horizon. Advocates of what is now called leaning against the wind believe that central banks seeking to smooth output and inflation can do so more successfully if they set rates with an eye towards asset prices in general and misalignments in particular. So we're not talking about asset price targeting, we're talking about taking account of misalignments. The second question is, should the measure of inflation targeted include an element of asset price and particularly house price inflation? Now, this is quite a crucial question, because if you don't include any element of house prices in the measure, then while the authorities may express anxieties about asset price inflation from time to time, they lack a framework within which to respond to them. The current definition of inflation in the UK and in the European Monetary Union excludes any element of housing costs. In the UK, the target rate was changed from the RPI, which did include an element of house rental, to the CPI on the model used in the euro area in 2003. Now, since then, the Bank of England has changed tack, and the governor has now argued that it would be preferable to change to a measure which did incorporate an element of housing costs. So there appears to be an emerging consensus on this point too. But just how sizable an element of housing costs should be incorporated is likely to prove far more controversial. In the US, the index does include an estimate of the price of owner occupation based on a survey of rental costs. but Cecchetti has calculated that the impact on US inflation, if you replace that by an index of home sale prices, would be dramatic. This shows the dotted line what the inflation rate would have been if you had included an index of house sale prices instead of imputed rents. And the effect is dramatic. Over 5 years from 2000, recomputed inflation would have been 0.75% a year higher than on the CPI index used. And the effect in the UK would have been even greater. The recomputed RPI, including house price inflation, would have been between 2% and 4% higher over the last decade. Now, it's unlikely that a recomputation on that scale is what King has in mind, and frankly, I don't think it would be useful to re-specify the index in this way. Would the Bank of England have kept interest rates significantly higher for some time on these grounds? Only, I think, if they were persuaded that there was indeed a serious misalignment. And on that question, opinion is divided. So while some readjustment of the index might be helpful as a signaling mechanism, and certainly including an element of house price rental equivalence, it's unlikely, I think, that the adjustment would be as dramatic as these calculations imply. But I think there is now a consensus that some element of house prices should be brought into the CPI. The third question, though, of my five, is where things get more difficult. Is it possible to identify serious asset price misalignments, and are they then of legitimate concern to monetary policymakers? Now, some say it's quite impossible to know ex ante whether or not a bubble has inflated. Ben Bernanke, before he joined the Fed, was a skeptic, noting advocates of bubbles would probably be forced to admit that it's difficult or impossible to identify any particular episode conclusively as a bubble, even after the fact, which is a rather remarkable claim. He went on nonetheless to acknowledge that episodes of irrational exuberance in financial markets are certainly a logical possibility, and one about which at least some central bankers are concerned. Now, Greenspan's position on this point is curious. When he made his celebrated comment about irrational exuberance in December 96, he appeared then to have reason to believe that prices were misaligned. But he now argues it's impossible to know when misalignments occur and that central banks should limit themselves to mopping up after the event. Now, others strongly dispute that misalignments cannot be identified at all. Cecchetti argues there are long-run measures which can help identify mispricing in the equity markets. One can think of extravagant PE ratios, more recently a dramatic fall in the risk premium on high-yield bonds, which ran for a couple of years at something like its half, its long-run average, was a strong sign of mispricing. In the case of housing, there are price-earnings ratios and perhaps more importantly, price-rental income ratios, which point to the likelihood of downward shifts. And the growth of credit aggregates may also be helpful in identifying unsustainable asset price increases. I don't think these indicators can be used as automatic triggers, and misalignments may persist for some time. But the uncertainties, it seems to me, are no greater than in many other areas where the monetary authority has to take a view on the basis of highly uncertain assumptions. It's not clear to me that looking at asset price misalignments is any more difficult than deciding on the output gap. And yet most monetary policy frameworks do depend on some assumption about the divergence of actual from trend output. Bernanke's attitude, it's fair to say, is now somewhat more nuanced than it was a few years ago. He's accepted that there can be circumstances in which asset price fluctuations are a legitimate concern to policyholders, to policymakers, and that there can be sources of non-fundamental price fluctuations which can be identified. And he accepts that booms and busts in asset prices have important effects on the real economy, in part, of course, as we've seen, because firms and households use assets as collateral for borrowing. So I think that there is emerging some view that it may be possible, at least on a by and large basis, to identify some element of misalignment. But this leads us to the next question, and this is one on which opinions do differ starkly. even if we can identify misalignments and believe some price adjustment is bound to occur, is it right to use interest rates to try to moderate the expansion and bring forward the adjustment? Now, it's very striking how often in this debate, which may seem arcane to many outside observers, the opposing sides caricature each other's positions in the worst tradition of political point scoring. So advocates of the use of the interest rate weapon prefer to use the non-threatening metaphor of leaning against the wind, suggesting nothing more hazardous than a brisk walk in a warm overcoat on a breezy morning. Those who resist it typically raise the stakes by talking of the risks of trying to prick bubbles, which sounds an inherently more hazardous activity, likely to be accompanied by loud noises and collateral damage. So Wadhwani, for example, talks of a gentle tilt in policy to reduce the risks of further inflation created by an emerging price bubble, while Bernanke argues there's no such thing as safe popping, and that bubbles can normally be arrested only by an increase in interest rates sharp enough materially to slow the whole economy. In his view, and the point is repeated regularly by his colleagues in the US and elsewhere, the scale of interest rate changes needed to make a significant impact on a price bubble would be so large as to threaten the health of the economy overall. Indeed, the Reserve Bank of Australia has advanced similar arguments recently. Guy Debelle, the Assistant Governor of Financial Markets, I always think that for an Englishman, an Australian with a French name, that's your worst nightmare, really, said in his speech in Chile, actually, perhaps safely long way away, nor do I believe there is much to be gained by leaning against the wind. But in my view, there is evidence that leaning can be quite useful. And indeed, there are some voices in the central bank community which argue as much. The former governor of the Swedish Riksbank, Lars Heikensten, said, "With house prices increasing drastically, on a few occasions in 2004-05, the Riksbank did, for that reason, not follow a strict inflation targeting rule. We leaned against the wind in the sense that we did not take rates down as quickly as we could have done, considering the outlook for inflation alone. We explicitly referred to asset prices in our published minutes, press releases, and speeches. And the Riksbank believed their actions did have a helpful effect on the expansion of asset prices in Sweden." And the ECB does also argue that it takes asset prices into account in the monetary pillar of its analytical framework. So there is, I think, a clear fault line here within the central banking community, though in public both sides are generally keen to play it down. The experience of 07-08 strengthened the hands of those who favored leaning against the wind, and the language used by governors has begun to change. But the Greenspan tendency is not down and out. And 2 months ago, Mervyn King argued that while maintaining price stability did not prevent a recession induced by a financial crisis, nevertheless, diverting monetary policy from its goal of price stability risks making the economy less stable and the financial system no more so. But both sides are agreed that interest rates are not the only weapon that can be used. And that leads us to the fifth and last question. Should we try to find and use mechanisms other than interest rates to moderate extravagant credit expansion and associated asset price bubbles? Now, I think almost all central bankers would now answer yes in principle to this question, whether or not they believe that interest rate changes should also be used to that end. Indeed, some seem to argue that while it's not possible for central banks as monetary authorities to spot a bubble, bank regulators should certainly be able to do so. A more sophisticated version of the argument is that the burden of proof on bank regulators is not as high as it is on monetary policy makers. The certainty needed to raise interest rates, given the likely impact on economic activity, is higher than is needed to justify a precautionary rise in capital ratios for banks active in the markets whose behavior is of concern. So on this argument, regulators can afford to take a chance now and again with fewer downside risks, and macroprudential adjustments to capital ratios are therefore a preferable response to bubbles, preferable to a rise in interest rates. But I am slightly doubtful about this argument, because raising capital ratios, requiring banks to hold more unremunerated reserves as a precautionary move will also affect the economy as a whole, unless regulators use some kind of sectoral approach, raising capital in relation to mortgage finance only, for example, which is likely to be politically highly unpopular. Credit rationing will feed through into the price through interest rate changes, which will themselves affect the monetary stance. So a macroprudential mechanism, putting the burden of dealing with asset prices onto banking regulators, is not, I think, an easy option. And in my view, should be considered alongside the interest rate decision, not apart from it. I can see that if you have an asset price problem that's particularly concentrated in the domestic housing market, it might be appropriate to use capital ratios for mortgage banks as a response to that. But if you have a more general asset price expansion and a boom in credit, it seems to me you must consider whether an interest rate change is the more appropriate response. So how do I conclude on these arguments? In my view, central banks should pay more attention to asset price bubbles than they have in the past. The output costs of bubbles are very large. The IMF estimates that equity market busts are typically associated with a 4% GDP loss, while sharp house price adjustments generate output losses twice as large. I'm not persuaded by the argument that bubbles cannot be identified ex ante. Of course, assessing price misalignments is not an exact science, but nor are many other aspects of monetary policy. All interest rate judgments are based on assessment of risk and the consideration of a range of possible outcomes. And there are indicators which can be used to identify potential misalignments. Furthermore, I think asset prices should be identified as an explicit factor in the consideration of policy, and an element of house prices should be incorporated in the index where they are not as soon as possible. That would help to explain policy. I don't think it's enough to say that an inflation target regime can, without amendment, take full account of asset price moves through adjusting the horizon. Inflation forecasts are usually based on assessments of likely inflation at a horizon of 2 years. It's in principle possible to imagine a regime which looks at longer horizons, but to do so may complicate the exposition of policy more than would a statement that explains that on occasion policy will be influenced by asset prices and credit expansion, and why. I don't think a policy reformulation along these lines poses any significant threat to the clarity of inflation targeting, which is a legitimate central bank concern. Now, that doesn't mean I reject the case for regulatory policies which try to work more directly on asset prices. The argument for more explicitly counter-cyclical adjustments of capital ratios is well made, but it's hard to avoid the conclusion that the new focus on regulatory policy is something of a smokescreen to conceal other policy areas, errors, especially in monetary policy. So I argue that in future, monetary policy decision makers in central banks should pay more attention to the creation of credit, both within and without the banks, in reaching decisions on interest rates. Now, it's been suggested that one way of doing so would be to give banks a statutory financial stability objective. And I think that is an idea worth considering. It has indeed, in a form, been implemented in the UK, though it's not yet clear how much it will influence policy there. And the governor currently seems skeptical that it will influence interest rates and sees it as about capital ratios only, which I think is unfortunate. I recognize that the interest rate weapon is powerful and blunt, and there will be circumstances in which it would be more appropriate to act directly on the expansionary appetites of banks themselves through adjusting capital requirements. But I think we have to accept that the application of additional capital requirements for macroeconomic reasons, not related to the risk positions of individual banks, is effectively a change in monetary policy because it will feed back to interest rates. If it's accepted that in future central bankers and supervisors should try to incorporate an understanding of the state of asset and credit markets in their decisions on capital requirements with the aim of leaning against the wind, then we need to consider by whom and on what grounds these decisions would be made. And the answer to that question depends on precisely what the ambition is. One can imagine prudential supervisory interventions designed to protect banks from the cycle, or which are designed to reduce the contribution to instability by the financial sector, which you might call protecting the cycle from the banks. At the extreme would be attempts to seek to moderate the business cycle itself by inducing banks to lean against it. I think the ambition should be the more limited one of dampening the impact of booms and busts in the banking system on the wider economy, which points to a lead role for regulators supported by central banks, where, as here and currently in the UK, they are separate. For competitive reasons, I think these decisions would have to be made on an international basis, because otherwise you risk putting banks in one country at a serious competitive disadvantage to others. Adjusting capital requirements, though, to the state of the economic cycle will be very difficult. The decision to impose higher capital requirements will require courage on the part of economists and supervisors. But if the assessments are agreed by central banks from a broad range of countries, they would have authority and would give the line supervisors the cover they need to impose unpopular taxes on their banks. Because we need to recognize that at bottom, a macroprudential tool, an adjustment in capital ratios for this purpose, is a tax, and one whose cost would largely be passed through to borrowers and savers. So I think now would be the right time to introduce a system of this kind when the memories of the crisis are fresh and the wounds still raw. At the G20 summit in London in April, the heads of government agreed in principle that macroprudential measures should be adopted, though it's not clear they knew quite what they were asking for. There is much work to do, I think, before a workable system is devised, but it should not blind us to the need to reintegrate financial market analysis, credit and asset prices into the monetary policy regime as well. I think if this approach to capital requirements is conceived as a substitute for a broader approach to monetary policy, which takes more account of financial stability, then it will inevitably disappoint. So I think it's very important to see that these macroprudential adjustments are a complement to a monetary policy which takes more account of the state of credit and asset markets and not an alternative to it. So, finally, to come back to my question, could central banks have done more to head off the crisis? Well, yes, indeed, I think they could have done. And since financial markets are, in the words of the song, forever blowing bubbles, central banks need to do better next time round. Thank you.